It's McCowan. It's Shannon for a Thursday, and we welcome you to the program. So as we record this, it's not even Eastern. It's whatever the Tampa Islanders series is called. What the hell is it called, John?
It's called a Stanley Cup semifinal.
Okay, but it hasn't got a conference attached to it or anything like that.
No, right? No. Can you adapt to that?
I'm having a difficult time.
They're going to play and present on Friday night. The Prince of Wales Trophy, though, so you can call it Prince of Wales Championship.
Well, that's sort of stupid, isn't it?
Because yes, it is. But it's a Stanley Cup semifinal, right?
So we're going to game seven. So after Tampa blows out the Islanders 8-0 the other night, Islanders come back, win an overtime. Yeah. And now we're going to a game seven. Perhaps similarly, although with a slight difference, later this evening, Montreal hosts Vegas in game six. And I guess the point of difference is that Montreal's at home. And I wonder, do you think that home ice advantage is tangibly less important in the playoffs than it is during the regular season? It seems statistically to bear that out.
It's hard to measure. In this series, obviously, it means nothing. Montreal's won two games in Las Vegas. And when they needed to win a game to tie the series at two, Vegas won in Montreal. So truthfully, it doesn't make a difference. I think when you look at the way that Montreal is doing what it's doing, which is clogging up the space between the blue lines and using their big four defensemen so effectively, and then you got Carey Price, I think you could play that game on Mars and they could win. So,
well, the principal difference, point of difference, forget the ambience of the arena, et cetera, but the principal difference is getting last change. Mm-hmm. And, then we spend, and again, that sounds like it's extremely important, and then we spend a considerable amount of time during the playoffs talking about the importance of the third and fourth lines and their contribution. And, we've heard things this week like, we don't care who our third line plays against. They can play against anybody. And the style of hockey is far more physical, far more grinding, far less skillful, and in my mind, far less entertaining. And so it makes sense that the third and fourth lines, who are functionally grinders, wind up being celebrated more. Yes?
Yeah, yes, although... I think when you look at what Montreal is, Montreal's depth, which includes those thirds and fourth lines. Where do you put Anderson and Caulfield and Suzuki? Are they a top six? I would argue that they're probably the third line anyway. The difference between these two teams right now is that Montreal is getting more effective play from more lines, and Vegas isn't. And Vegas can't score.
That's Vegas. Their entire problem has been that they can't score. They scored consistently during the regular season. They even scored against Colorado in that series, but they've gone bone dry.
Well, the interesting thing, Bob, and we talked about this a ton during the 56-game schedule, is the North weaker? Is the North really the ugly stepchild of the three divisions? And now when you think about it, that Western division that had Colorado and Minnesota and St. Louis and Vegas in it, it also had three what I would describe as also-rans in the three California teams, San Jose, Anaheim, and the Kings. And did Colorado and Minnesota and Vegas just, score lots against those teams and beat up on them? And now that they're having issues, the other thing is there's one line particularly, I think, in Vegas that has been a no-show, an absolute no-show. And I'm not talking about Stone and Pacioretty, because they were at a disadvantage without Stevenson, who I assume was going to be back for game six as well. And that's the second line, the Smith, Carlson, and Marchessault line. Jonathan Marchessault has been a phantom in this series, an absolute phantom. And you remember, now this is ancient history now, when this team went to the Stanley Cup final, and any time this team has made some impact in the playoffs, it was that Carlson, Marchessault, and Smith line that has really made an impact. And they have done squat. Squat, Bob. That's with a capital S. And I think you have to wonder, have they squeezed enough out of these three guys, not just this year, but for the last 4 years? And are we going to see some major changes in Vegas if they get eliminated by Montreal?
We will know more later this evening as game six between Vegas and Montreal takes place. And then tomorrow, game seven, the Islanders and Tampa. And we are very close to a Stanley Cup final. Baseball on the agenda today. The Toronto Blue Jays, as of this moment, have won four in a row. And we're going to talk about the ebb and flow in the game of baseball that is unlike any other sport. Dan Shulman of Sportsnet will join us when we come back after these messages. It's Bob McCowan. It's John Shannon on the program for today. And look what the cat dragged in. Our buddy Dan Shulman, the voice of the Blue Jays on Sportsnet, is with us. Well, so I got something to throw at you guys that's kind of, maybe it's obvious, but I had never thought about this. And I don't know what, I think it was this. So the Blue Jays are now on a four-game winning streak. And I started thinking about this, and I thought about the emotional ebbs and flows that a fan goes through over the course of a season. And I'm going to throw something at you two guys and see how you react. Baseball, for whatever reason, and I think we can analyze that, has more ebbs and flows than any other sport. Hockey team, beginning of the year, they're pretty good. You expect them to be pretty good, and generally they are. Basketball, football, almost every other sport. Baseball, you will change your opinion on your team 20 times over the course of a year. Mm-hmm. And we're literally in kind of that phase right now with the Blue Jays, who lost, what, Danny, five or six in a row? And now have won four in a row, and albeit against inferior opposition. But do you sense that as you're doing games?
Oh, yeah, 1,000%. I think there are a couple of, whether they're valid reasons or not, but real reasons for it. One is you got twice as many games as you do in an NHL mm-hmm. season or an NBA season. So you got twice as many times, twice as many opportunities to say, wow, they're great, or boy, I need a drink. I can't watch these guys anymore. And I think baseball, too, different than hockey or basketball, you can break down a game. So why did he bring in that pitcher? Why wasn't the infield in? Why don't they have a pinch hitter now? Like, you can do more of that with a baseball game, I think, than you can with hockey or basketball. But yes, I sense it because I've got Twitter open while I'm doing the games. And like literally the same people sometimes in the sixth inning will say, fire him, he shouldn't do that. And then like in the eighth inning, it's, wow, that move worked out great. And you know, you just have to block it out a little bit. But you know, these are the people who make sports what it is, right? I mean, they may be a little off their rocker sometimes, but it's their passion that fuels the whole industry.
Don't you think that has a little bit of to do with the style of schedule as well? Because we got a sense of that during this shortened NHL season, where teams were actually on three-game homestands against the opposition. And you could understand momentum changes and momentum shifts a lot more. And that, you know, if you ever got to the point where you won three in a row, you see a little bit of this, I think, Bob, you'd agree with this, during the NHL season, particularly in the Northern Division, where every team except the Maple Leafs went on a swoon really badly. And it, to me, that was representative of what you play three against Edmonton, and the Leafs, you know, beat them three times, and now the world's falling apart in Edmonton. And so the Jays go somewhere and play the White Sox, lose three to the White Sox, and all of a sudden the world's falling apart. And so it's not only the length of the schedule, but I think the style of the schedule probably has a bit of an impact too.
Yeah, I think so. And also, I think the fact that you play teams in your own division so much, you play, you know, the Blue Jays play their divisional rivals 19 times. 76 of their 162 games come against four other teams. even if you leave Baltimore out of the mix, 57 of the 162 are against the three most important teams to them in the Rays, the Yankees, and the Red Sox. And, you know, to borrow a hockey term, those are all four-pointers, every single one of them.
Yeah.
You have a four-pointer night after night after night. And so that creates, I think, stress and strain. I think the injuries this year, too, across baseball have really done it. You know, if you're healthy, you can be much better than an injured team, even if you're not much better than them, but you're healthy right now. And also particular to the Blue Jays this year, their schedule was incredibly difficult, really, until this past week or so when they started playing Baltimore and Miami. They had the toughest schedule in baseball. They had the most road games in the American League. That, you know, they hadn't played the Orioles at all. So that creates a lot of angst as well. But who you're playing does matter. It's not just how you're playing. It's also who you're playing. I'm not sure they're playing any better against Baltimore and Miami than they did against the White Sox and the Astros. It's just Baltimore and Miami aren't very good. And so they're winning more of these games.
Well, home field advantage is an interesting thing too. I know people overestimate it. In baseball, home team wins 53% of the time.
Yeah.
Now, I grant you, there are a lot of crummy teams out there that, you know, as the famous saying goes, we can't win at home, we can't win on the road, and we can't figure out where else we can play. So that's a factor. But one of the things we saw in the Yankee series, the recent Yankee series in Buffalo, was Blue Jays weren't the home team. Mm-hmm. That crowd was cheering for the New York Yankees. And if you're a Blue Jay fan, you can be angry about that, but you have to be understanding that there's an historic and a geographic connection to New York that doesn't exist with Toronto. But how disadvantaged is this Toronto Blue Jay team playing in Buffalo?
I think the whole season disadvantages them. And I'm not just saying, I mean, it's a little bit of a few different things. I think it probably bugged them down in Dunedin that the Rays, Phillies, Yankees and Braves all felt like home teams.
Yep.
In Buffalo, as you mentioned, Bob, it's just the Yankees. Nobody else. I don't think the Red Sox. It's just the Yankees. So, but still, you know, and even stuff that we maybe don't think about or talk about enough, you know, many of them are married. Many of them have kids. When are we going to Buffalo? Are we going to Toronto? Should I bring my family with? Do we pull them out of school? I don't know if I can get them across the border, whatever. I mean, there's stuff on their minds, and the facilities, I'm sure, are the absolute best they can be in Buffalo. They're still not as good as they are in Toronto. So, you know, in our little corner of the universe, the little fun and games area we call sports, I think they are disadvantaged. Like, there are much bigger things going on in a pandemic than the Toronto Blue Jays being disadvantaged. But, you know, how you quantify that into how many wins it's cost them, I don't know. But I do feel badly for them, and somebody deserves a lot of credit for the fact that we have not heard complaining. And whether that's Mark Shapiro or Ross Atkins or Charlie Montoyo or the leadership group of the players or a combination of the above, I think they've done a great job just saying, you know what, this is the situation that we're in and we got to deal with it and go play games. Because, you know, last year you heard a couple of little comments, this year nothing, like nobody's complaining. And I do feel for them. I hope they get back to Toronto this year. I'm not sure they're going to. Like, we know the border is starting to open, and I hope Blue Jay fans from Toronto flood across the border for that Yankee series in September, if the Blue Jays are still playing down there in September. But I'm not sure they're getting back here this year.
Really, huh?
Really? That's interesting, because I would have thought that if we're able to cross the border that way, and I'm making an assumption here, Dan, if the team is completely vaccinated.
They're not. That's the assumption.
That's my assumption. Maybe in August we may see the team play in Toronto.
Yeah, I don't believe any team is 100% vaccinated. The Blue Jays. So Major League Baseball, as you guys know and I'm sure have discussed, when you reach an 85% vaccination rate of your traveling party, not just your players. Mm-hmm. So say there are 60 people, coaches, trainers, whatever. When you reach 85%, that's when MLB kind of loosens the restrictions, and that's why you see Charlie Montoyo, Pete Walker, et cetera. Nobody's wearing masks anymore because the Blue Jays got there about 2 weeks ago. But there's no way they're 100% vaccinated. There's no way there's any team that has every single person in the traveling party 100% vaccinated. And even if the Blue Jays were, let's say the Yankees aren't. Let's say the Yankees have 5 people of their 60 who aren't vaccinated. Is the federal government going to let them cross the border? I hope I'm wrong. Like, I hope they say, okay, it's 55 out of 60. and Yankees, will you agree to stay bubbled up for 3 days? I don't know if the Yankees will agree to that. And again, if the Blue Jays have 5 or 6 people who aren't vaccinated, you can't ask them to stay in a bubble for this 7-day homestand and that 10-day homestand, et cetera. So that's why I'm worried, John, is, you know, Canadians will be allowed to go to Buffalo. Vaccinated Canadians will be allowed to go to Buffalo and come back. Mm-hmm. But the last I saw was just Canadians, actually. It wasn't, I didn't see that vaccinated Americans can come into Canada without quarantining. So that's one level. And then the next level is, what about, you know, what if Aaron Judge, I'm just making up a name, what if Aaron Judge is not vaccinated? Like, are they going to say, sorry, you can't come? Because then guess what? The Yankees aren't coming. So I hope they can figure this out. I just think there are some things to consider that maybe, you know, that we haven't really fully given a lot of consideration to so far.
Well, a precedent sort of has been set in the NHL because the Vegas team has come across the border. And John, do you know, they're not fully vaccinated?
No, they're in a bubble.
They're in a bubble.
They're in a bubble. They had to fly privately, which obviously every pro sports team does now. And they're not allowed to leave their hotel rooms. They're not allowed to, you know, go to restaurants or even to go to an outside bar for a beer. They're not, they've got arena, airport, hotel. That's it.
And so, sorry to interrupt, say you're the Blue Jays, never mind the visiting team for a second. Right now in Buffalo, you can go out and have dinner. You can go out and have a beer. You can walk around. So if you're the Blue Jays, do your players want to come home for a 10-game homestand if the condition is you have to live at the Rogers Center? I'm not sure the players would want to do that, and I kind of get it. So yeah. I'm not saying they're not coming. I'm just saying I'm not sure it's a given that they are coming.
Well, it raises another very important factor, and that is with all the evaluations that a team does in drafting players and analyzing their skill set, one of the things that they have never taken into consideration is political affiliation. And clearly, you should not be drafting Republicans because they're the ones who are and not getting their shot.
Danny, we had John Gibbons on Monday, and I felt like John D'Amico, an old linesman breaking up the fight off air between John and Bob all day.
I could see that. I think when I go get my second shot today, I doubt John Gibbons will be in line in front of me at the vaccination center.
No, he did get vaccinated.
God bless him. I mean, I disagree with his political affiliation, but I love the guy dearly. So.
Oh, we all do. Yeah.
You know. Relief pitching has been such an issue with this team. And we went through this period at the beginning of the year where the bullpen was just awesome. And then they just completely disintegrated for a month or more. And now all of a sudden everything's golden again. I know you can't explain this, but explain this.
Well, the last two games, they've used the three best guys they have. And I know people are going to scoff at the Tyler Chatwood thing, but if you look at who's in the bullpen, he's one of the three best guys they have.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, he had as bad a 2 weeks as you can have, unbelievably bad 2 weeks, but he's now made 5 consecutive good appearances, pretty clean appearances. So Meza, Chatwood, Romano were the three best they have because they were all so efficient on Tuesday night. They were all able to come back on Wednesday night and pitch again. As we speak Thursday morning, if the Blue Jays have a lead Thursday night, none of those three guys, I don't think any of those three guys are pitching tonight.
No.
So you're going to see 4, 5, and 6 where 1, 2, and 3 should be. But I think they were out over their skis as a group a little bit early. You know, Anthony Castro had a great start, had a really nice run. Travis Bergen had a really nice run for a while. Phelps was healthy. Baruchy was healthy. You know, it's been a lot of different things, a little bit of regression to the mean and some injuries, obviously, that have caused this problem. And I think if they're going to make the playoffs this year, they're going to need to have more in the bullpen than they have right now. Now, whether that means Merriweather and Baruchy get healthy, who knows? They've both been hurt so often. Unfortunately, you know, you can't count on that. Is it something, you know, off the beaten path, like John Axford showing up and helping? Who knows? It would be a great story. Everybody loves him. And we'll see what the next couple of weeks hold for him. Is it Thomas Hatch going into the bullpen? Again, who knows? But they need, or trades, obviously. They need more than they've got. And relief, you know, I always say the definition of a relief pitcher is a failed starter. There's not one relief pitcher in the majors who, when he was 14 years old, was a relief pitcher. Not one of them. Right. They're relief pitchers because they don't have as many quality pitches or the stamina or enough to get through an order two or three times. So I think by definition, relief pitchers are going to be more volatile in terms of their performance than starting pitchers for the most part. So, July 30th, which is the trade deadline this year, it's still 5 and a half weeks away. That's a long time. That's a lot of games between now and then. And I think if they've got to jump the gun a little bit and figure not wait till late July, and I'm sure they're trying. It's hard to make trades in June. It doesn't happen very often, but what happened the last two nights is great, but I don't think anybody should think that that's going to be the norm going forward.
Just popped into my head. Manoah gets thrown out for hitting a guy.
Yeah.
I was going to say throwing at a guy, but he was successful. So I think you have to say he hit him. And look, I think we're all old enough to remember the day where if you gave up two home runs in a row, which is what Manoah did, the next guy better not dig in too deep in the box because he's probably going to get one thrown at him. This pitch was not at his head. And Manoah can say it was an accident that slipped out of his hand. We'll never know the reason. But generally speaking, and this is generally speaking, you give a guy a warning. There was no warning here. They just tossed him right away. I'm not questioning the ability under the rules of an umpire to do that. But was that too much? Were you surprised?
I was surprised. Yeah, because as you say, it's highly unusual. The typical way this goes is Manoah hits Franco. Warnings are issued. Brandon Hyde comes out and he says, what are you giving my guy a warning for when their guy hit my guy? Everybody's angry. And then it kind of stops there. It's highly unusual that I can remember to see a guy thrown out without a prior incident or warnings being given. And then it didn't occur to me that suspensions were coming, but I guess it should have. Mm-hmm. He was thrown out of a game for throwing at a guy. And that leads
five
to
games.
Suspension. Yeah. And it's five games because he's a starting pitcher, right? If you give him three games, that's pointless. So he's appealed. I don't know. Maybe they'll drop it to four. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll try to strategically take it at a certain time. I don't know what they'll do, but it did surprise me a little bit, but I'm curious to see, you know, Alek Manoah is a big personality. There's a lot going on the mound when he's out there. He is not a super command guy. Even in Buffalo, those three incredible starts that where he overwhelmed people and got called up, he hit four batters in those three starts. He hit three of them in one game. This is not a guy who can, you know, dot it on the outside corner with the knees very often. Like you said, Bob, who knows if he hit him on purpose or not. But I will say this. I think every umpire knows who Alek Manoah is right now. And I think it's just worth, he might need to hear from an older pitcher or a pitching coach and say, hey, like, ease into this a little bit. You know, there again, that personality probably is what drives him and helps make him a good pitcher as well. But you might have to just keep an eye on it for a while and make sure he doesn't get on the wrong side of too many people.
I want to talk about the rosin suntan oil thing and a few other interesting tidbits. We'll take a break first. Dan Shulman is with us. We'll come back after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon, and it's Shulman on the program for today. All right, you know, I keep hearkening back to the good old days, as they say, when we all started following baseball. And look, it wouldn't have been tremendously shocking to any of us if a starting pitcher back in the 1970s pulled a buzzsaw out of his back pocket and started carving up the baseball to try and gain an advantage. Putting junk on the bill of your hat, rubbing the baseball against your belt buckle, you probably remember the video of the pitcher who the umpire's coming out to check him for a banned substance. And he throws his hands up and a nail file.
Necro.
Yeah.
That was Necro.
Was it Necro? Yeah. And the nail file falls out. I mean, we chuckle at this kind of stuff, but it's always been kind of a part of baseball, and you don't want to allow it. But how do you feel about this, what's going on right now?
Well, as much as I love baseball, and obviously I do, you know, this sport lends itself to the temptation of cheating more than any of the other sports. And it's
if
not
you ain't cheating, you ain't trying, Dan.
That's right. Yeah. You know, whether it's the, you know, gambling, Black Sox 1919, whether it's spitballs or belt buckles or nail files, and like, let's not.
Or garbage cans.
Garbage cans. How about corked bats and rubber balls and bats? Yep. Like the hitters aren't entirely innocent over the course of the sport, over the history of the sport either. But I kind of liken it to parenting. Like the parents make the rules and then the kids push the boundaries, and the kids push too hard here. Baseball, and I'm not blaming the play. I think there's blame on both sides. I think there's blame that this wasn't dealt with before it got to this level, and that's on baseball. And I think there's blame on the pitchers that it got out of hand as it did. What I worry about is I don't know what the easy fix is here. So one way to do it is you're not allowed any substance, which is the rule right now. And I don't think they should have done this to the degree they did in the middle of the season. I don't think this was the way to do it. I'm foolish and naive. So I think the right way to do it is to get a committee in a room of general managers, pitchers, hitters, like management and union, get them all in the room together and find out what everybody can agree on. But, you know, the owners and the players treat each other like adversaries more than partners, obviously. So I don't think that's ever going to happen. But apparently the hitters are saying, well, we didn't want this. You went too far. Like now this guy's throwing the ball and I'm worried he's going to hit me right in the neck. We were okay with sunscreen and rosin. We're just not okay with the sticky tack. So here's the problem. If they're not allowed anything, then you're going to have Sergio Romo dropping his pants on the field.
Right.
If you're allowed this, but not that, now the umpires need a chemistry degree in order to go out there and figure, well, where is it and what is it? And how are they going to know? So I think this is a can of worms, to be honest with you right now. And I don't know how they fix it.
And I mean, when I watch Joe Girardi and Max Scherzer, I see a manager saying, we got to get this guy off his game. It's got nothing to do with substances. It's got to do with, we've got to get between Scherzer's ears because he's really killing us.
Right.
So now he's got Scherzer so upset and he, you know, between, and they're yelling between dugouts and they're yelling at each other and Girardi's got nothing to lose, nothing to lose.
Yeah.
And that's another side effect that they did not consider.
Well, and here's another one. And I've heard this compared to hockey. You know, you want to measure an illegal stick. If you ask for it and it's legal, you get a penalty, right? So I don't know what penalty you could have in a baseball, but let's say it's you lose your review. You can only ask for a pitcher to be checked if you have a challenge. And if he's clean, you lose your challenge. Well, so now what if I'm a pitcher and I know they've only got one crack at me and I spend the whole game deliberately touching my belt buckle, touching my hat, touching my hair. Now I'm trying to make them crazy. I'm trying to bait them into using their challenge. Like the whole thing becomes a sideshow. And it's cute and funny now, but I bet you in 2 weeks, we're going to be like, man, this ain't right. This has got to go. And to me, the best, I wouldn't even say solution. The best possibility is that they come up with a baseball that isn't as slick as it is. So that the pitchers say, yeah, I can grip this without anything. And the hitters say, yeah, we're okay with that too. We trust them not to hit us in the neck because the ball is tackier. But then you've still got the issue of guys are going to try to cheat. And I don't know how they fix this. And I give them credit for doing it when the pitcher's coming off the field. They're trying not to delay the game and all that. But I don't know what the solution is.
Well, let me give you another scenario here. We also grew up in an era where a baseball only was taken out of play essentially when it went into the crowd.
Right.
Otherwise, you played until the baseball wasn't usable anymore. Now, every a ball hits the ground, ground ball, fly ball, any a ball hit, 99 times out of 100, baseball's changed. Baseball's brought this essentially by doing that. They brought it on themselves because now you have baseballs that, okay, they're rubbed down before games, but they're not, we've all had brand new baseballs. They're a lot slicker than a baseball that's been hit a couple times. You don't have any place to grip it. I wonder whether you can go back to that. And then I also see, this is the other thing that you can explain to me, Shulman. Pitcher comes in, a guy gets a hit, baseball's exchanged, they throw a ball out to him, he takes a look, he says, I don't like that one, and throws it back. Yeah. What's a new baseball for another new baseball? And I know the laces aren't the same on every single baseball, but my goodness.
I know. I can't explain that. Now, you're exactly right. It's just a pitcher saying, I can't get it. The seams aren't high enough. This one's too slick. I can't get a grip. And I don't think they can institute a rule where you say you can't take a baseball out of play. But, you know, there are 10 different ways where somebody can make a Romo out of a situation if they want. If a pitcher really wants to make a mockery of this, a pitcher can make a mockery of this in whatever the way they want to do. And I don't know what the easier solution is. I think either it's a tackier baseball or it's a universally agreed upon substance where everybody says, this is the substance you can use. This is the only substance you can use. But how is an umpire to be sure when he goes out and checks that that's all that's in that substance? You know, it's on my forearm and I've been sweating all day in the middle of a game. How's an umpire supposed to know if McCown is kosher, but Shannon added something into it? The burden is on the umpires. And I don't think anybody should be getting mad at the umpires. They didn't make the rule here.
That's the other thing. This is such a serious issue and has been forever. Let's face it. Doctoring baseballs has been an issue for as long as I've been alive and longer than that, I'm sure.
I just wouldn't categorize it, John, as being serious. I think it's humorous and interesting and a topic of discussion. But
why would you put a rule in place during the season?
Right.
No. This is an off-season discussion.
Yes, because it wasn't
an off-season discussion.
Well, here's why they did it. Because technology, specifically the ability to measure spin rate and to understand what spin rate does for fastballs, sliders, curveballs, cut fastballs as well. Understanding what spin rate does and the impact it can have on hitters is significant. Everybody understands that if I throw 94 with a 2200 RPM spin rate, if I can get that spin rate up to 2400, I'm going to get a lot more swing and miss. The ball is going to carry. That's the late life, the jump, that sort of thing. It's something that a lot of people would say. I've had a ton of hitters, like guys I've worked with as broadcasters who were hitters in the 80s, say. I've had a ton of guys look at Marco Estrada as an example and say, I buy it. It's got that late life. It doesn't drop as much as I think. I know it's only 89, but there's Marco Estrada must have been a great spin rate guy. How do you get great spin rate? Two ways. You're either Pedro Martinez, who has said, look, I have freakishly flexible fingers, and that allows the ball to come off my hand differently than other people, or you put sticky stuff on your hand. So this is all analytics and technology combining together to allow pitchers this really significant advantage. And the reason baseball did it now, and I think it's wrong, but the reason baseball did it now is I think they are hell-bent on reducing the number of strikeouts and getting the ball in play more. And they should be. I just don't know that right now this way was the way to do it. But I think they're understanding that if they want to be as relevant as they are a couple of generations from now, they've got to have more action, and more action is fewer strikeouts.
Here's something I'm really intrigued by your perspective on it. Are pitchers using the rosin bag a lot less than they used to?
I don't know that I know the answer to that. I mean, apparently, like, the base level substance is rosin and sunscreen. So right. You spray some sunscreen on your off forearm, your left forearm. If you're a righty, you go to the rosin bag, you pat it down, and you've got a little paste, kind of a little sticky paste. Yeah. So, you know, the rosin bag is to, in theory, I think, is to dry out your hand when you're sweating.
Exactly.
Right. So I think they're still using it because if my hand is sweaty, the wetter your hand is, I believe the less spin rate you're going to get because the ball just kind of slips off your fingers. It doesn't snap off your fingers.
Except Scherzer talked about needing to get some moisture on his hand, and then he started going to his hair because his head was sweaty.
Right, because he was too dry, I guess.
That was the thing that I went, well, wait a second. You got a rosin bag there if you want to dry it off, but now you want to, you want your hand to be moister.
Yeah. Like, you know, yeah, I'm not as well versed in this as I should be. And whatever the game, whatever the angle is, people are going to try to exploit it one way or another. And, you know, you wonder even things like in Colorado as an example, where the air is thinner and drier, does a ball feel different? Never mind how the ball flies. You know, you hear all kinds of stories. Well, curveballs don't break as much in Colorado. And maybe that's altitude. Maybe it's also just that the air is so dry, they can't get a good enough grip on it. It slips off. It's slicker. I have no idea. But it's not going away. I don't think this issue is going away. But again, I would advocate for people on both sides, players and management, to get in a room and say, okay, let's have some peace talks here. Let's see what we can agree on. But I think baseball is just going to impose what it wants to impose without the players' input. And I think that's a mistake.
All right, here's one. I mean, and I preface this by saying, when I was younger, I umpired for several years. I understand how tough that job is. I'm sympathetic to it. However, we live in an era, as we all know, where there's a statistic for everything. And then you take that statistic and you combine it with six other statistics, and then you get another statistic. And trying to figure out which of those statistics is the most important is a task that I have no interest in engaging in. Here's a statistic that does not exist to the best of my knowledge, at least not a public statistic. We have watched you and Buck and Tabler call games and marvel at umpires calling pitches strikes that are 3 inches outside the strike zone. And that happens a lot more than strikes that are called balls, pitches that are good that are called balls.
Yes.
It's much more the other way around. When is somebody going to come up with a statistic that rates the umpires based on their ability to call balls and strikes?
Go to a Twitter account. I believe it's Umpire Scorecards.
Oh, really? It exists?
Oh, yeah. You want to go down a rabbit hole, go to Umpire Scorecards. I believe every day you will see a scorecard of every game the night before, and it will rank, it will not rank, it will critique umpires on two things. What percentage of the pitches were called correctly, balls are balls and strikes are strikes, and how consistent is the umpire? And I don't know what the formula is for that, but in other words, if...
I get it. I understand.
Right. So they're being evaluated on two things, because hitters will always tell you, fine, if that's a strike, that's a strike, but it better be a strike all the time or a ball all the time. It's out there. I don't know if the people who do this are getting paid for their trouble or if it's just some kind of crazy hobby that they're into. But the one thing you said resonates with me. This is hard. The ball's coming in at 98 miles an hour.
Oh, I get it.
It's extremely hard. And I don't begrudge these guys for making some mistakes. There have been some this year, like 4 or 5 inches off the outside corner, like not close. And they're getting called strikes. I was always very lukewarm on the whole electronic strike zone or robot umpire, whatever you want to call it. And I don't know if the technology is foolproof. If the technology is foolproof, I'm in. I think it's time. I just don't know if it is yet.
Well, I mean, the Hawkeye system in tennis has, yeah, you know, has been adopted and proven. And if those same people, which are they're out of London, England, if they can make that work for baseball,
yep,
the biggest problem, Danny, is that there's even though the stadiums look the same, there's a non-conformity of stadiums. And that becomes the real issue of where you put your
key points.
By the way, there is a similar website, a Twitter account for NHL referees that you were talking about for the umpires. And I was talking to somebody at the league about it the other day, and they said, oh, that's that gambling account. So with gambling coming in, and I mean, we're on the verge of getting, you know, single sport gambling in Canada within the next month. And it's already in what, 22 or 23 states, you know, this type of information that you're talking about, Bob, is going to be so important and so valuable, and they're going to make money somehow, Dan.
Let me tell you two other issues about the electronic strike zone. Tennis, the technology is fantastic in tennis. That's two dimensional. It's just, did it land in or did it land out? The strike zone is three.
Right.
So that to me seems a lot harder. And also, You know, a 6'6 guy strike zone is different than a 5'10 guy strike zone. So there's you've got to take that into account. And I assume all of these things are manageable, but I don't remember which level of the minors or whether it's one of the independent leagues they're using it again this year. But I do know this, every experimental thing that's happening in the minors right now is happening because Major League Baseball is taking a serious look at whether it should be in the majors. So I think it's coming. I think it's just a matter of whether it's 2 years or 10 years until they can figure it out.
And you, when you say three-dimensional, there's lots of people that you're talking because there's a depth of the strike zone. More so,
there
it's not
is
just
a depth to the plate, and it's a cube. The strike zone is in effect a rectangular cube. It's not it's not a flat piece of paper. Like, did it go, unless you make it that way? So, but you know, how often have you guys heard it's not where the catcher catches it, it's where it crosses the plate? Well, the plate is not a flat thing. It has depth to it, front and back. So, you know, what if it's easier for fastballs, but with with breaking balls, I think it's harder. So is the issue, does it just have to go anywhere in that three-dimensional cube? I mean, a pitch could almost bounce and still be called a strike. So I think they got to sort some of these details.
Well, let me try and bring this down to earth here. I think we would all understand that if the technology only measured, as you said, the flat plane of the leading edge of the plate, and that's all it measured, fine. If the pitch, if a pitch is off by a tenth of an inch with the technology, we're going to be fine with that. What we assume is there's not going to be a pitch that's 3 inches or 5 inches off the plate that's going to be called a strike.
Right. It's going to clean up the most egregious calls.
And those are the ones that drive you crazy, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's a good point. And if something can be 90% better, but not 100% better, it's still 90% better.
Thank you.
But this is the one sport. This is the one sport where that post-strike decision argument could go on forever. This is and you talked about it right off the top, Dan. This is the cheating sport more than any other. There will be a manager, there will be some director of IT with a baseball team that will find a way to create an illusion somehow, some way. I agree with you, Bob. I think it makes a ton of sense, but this is the one sport where they're going to fight it more than anything else.
Last point before we let you go, Danny boy. Last night was almost without question the worst, most embarrassing performance by an umpire in any game that I can recall seeing ever. And that was the guy at first base last night who had what? Three overturned.
Yeah. Overturned. Yeah.
Well, help me. Like what?
So his name is Ryan Wills. And you know, I write umpires' names in my scorebook daily.
Of course.
I don't know the name Ryan Wills. So my guess is he is a minor league umpire who is filling in for someone who's on vacation relief. I might be wrong, but that happens a lot. There are always minor league umpires. Yeah. Umpires don't work 26 consecutive weeks. They get a little vacation time and guys get called up from AAA to fill in. You know, that notwithstanding, I'm just saying I'm not familiar with Ryan Wills. That's not a name that I know. It was tough to watch. You feel for the guy.
Yeah, you do.
But they were big mistakes. They were big mistakes. And I don't know if he was nervous, so he forgot some of his fundamentals, like I look at the bag and I listen for the ball to hit the mitt. I don't know if he, you know, just got out of it. But I feel for him. I don't know what the answer is, other than I assume baseball evaluates these guys. And when they see that one umpire has three calls overturned in one game, it's going to be tough for him to get good assignments.
Well, and you know, the ball first or the foot first, I mean, you know, and a really, really close play, we understand you can make a mistake. But included in the reviews was the tag by Ray on the ground ball in the infield.
Yeah.
Well,
which was obvious.
It was pretty obvious. And you know, the replay clearly showed his glove supinating or pronating, whichever the case may be, it's a golf thing, you know, And I never figured it out. I know the two words. I just don't know what they mean. But you could see it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's the kind of thing he should have been looking for. The guy was still a stride away from the bag. He didn't have to be focused on the base at that moment in time. Right. He should have been looking for that possibility, and he didn't.
Yeah, that was the easiest one. The other one was when Aguilar took his foot off the bag. So again, the first base umpire, to my understanding, is trained look for the runner's foot on the bag, listen for the ball in the mitt. So the fielder's foot is a third element here. That's not typically, I guess, what you're supposed to look at, but you kind of have to. It's part of the job to understand if the foot comes off the bag. The other one that he missed, I think, was just bang, bang, and he called it wrong. It was pretty close. The third one wasn't as bad. There was another bad call by the home plate umpire on the ball that spun back towards the fouler. The start of foul and spun back.
And Ray got it before it came fair.
Right. So there were actually four bad calls, but that was the home plate umpire who made that call. But yeah, it was not a good performance. And you know how a fielder who makes errors is probably sitting there internally during a game saying, please don't hit it to me. Please don't hit it to me. I'm sure that the umpire was saying, please don't let me have any more calls in this.
Yeah, nothing but fly balls, please.
Yeah. Yeah. And on a human level, I felt for him, but to paraphrase Josh Donaldson, this isn't the tri league. This is the get it done league. And on every level, these are supposed to be the best in the business.
Yeah. George Springer. Hold on, Jim. We got to talk about George Springer. I mean,
there's not much to talk about. He hasn't got a hit yet.
We have to teach everybody to be patient, and it's going to take some time.
Yeah, he'll be fine. He'll hit. And I actually like the fact that they are hitting him fifth. I think Marcus Semien has done, he's been out there every single day for this team for 2.5 months. He was the American League Player of the Month, for crying out loud, in May. I just think he deserves a chance to stay where he is. Now, if in a week or two or three, he's cold, or Bichette's cold, or Springer is smoking hot, or whatever it is, then you make a change. But I like that they're kind of easing Springer back in. He seems like he's taking it in stride, and he told the media, he said, Charlie, wherever you want to put me is fine. But, as the old saying goes, the players make out the lineup card, and eventually it'll be what it's supposed to be. And it's funny, people totally forget that just last year, I think it was last year, that Bichette was the leadoff hitter and Biggio was hitting second. And then one day they said, let's flip him. And then Biggio became the leadoff hitter and Bichette hit second. Like, whatever it is now is not whatever it's going to be until the end of time. It's going to work out fine. And if all of their guys are healthy, they couldn't screw this up if they tried. They got too many good hitters. They're going to score a lot of runs the rest of the way.
Well, the other thing too, just as an aside, you brought Semien in on a one-year deal, and you asked him to play a position that he wasn't familiar with. And he has done that without complaining, and he's done it very well.
Yeah.
And I think you want to re-sign this guy if you can. I mean, he's an impressive talent that I really...
He's won the lottery, won the lottery.
Yeah, he's going to be a rich man. I mean, he's going to go... I think one of the things for him, there's so many shortstops who are free agents in Story and Correa and Seager and Baez. I mean, four big-time names. If Semien insists on being a shortstop, he's gonna be in that group competing with those guys. If he's happy being a second baseman, he's gonna make a lot of money anyways. But I'm sure they would love to sign him. But he could be at the 4-year, $90 million. It could be huge money for him.
I don't disagree. I'm not sure he's not worth it.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's not worth it either. I think they'd love to have him back. I say this tongue in cheek, but he's a grown-up in the room, and they got a lot of kids, and it's nice to have a couple of grown-ups in there. And he's a serious grown-up who goes about his business in a professional, lead by example sort of way. And I think there are a lot of good things the younger players can learn from a guy like Marcus Semien, and hopefully they're already doing that this year.
Danny Boy, always our pleasure. Thanks, pal, for taking time for us.
Thank you. Be well, guys.
We'll talk to you again soon. That's Dan Shulman. We'll come back to wrap it after these messages. McCowan and Shannon here. Thanks again to Dan Shulman for joining us. It's been too long, and hopefully it
won't. he mentioned the whole thing about John Axford signing or investigating, the Jays investigating having Axford come back. I'd only be concerned if they wanted Siddle to come back and catch. That would be my biggest concern. So
catchers they got. I mean, and catchers they got coming too.
Hey, how about that play the other night with McGuire from his knees? Gosh. Shades of you when you were behind, when you were a catcher. I'm sure. Oh no, you were a pitcher.
No, I was a pitcher. I'm not going to hide. I'm not going to hide my pretty face behind a mask. Are you serious?
I was a catcher, so
this does not surprise me even in the least.
And I would have been a goalie, but there was one issue. So
yeah, well, there's not much to talk about here at this moment in time. But one of the things we haven't mentioned is the Toronto Raptors got the fourth pick in the NBA draft, which is actually quite significant. They should have been seventh. They could have been 10th. Mm-hmm. They wound up fourth.
Yeah.
And the average fan may say, okay, well, they moved up three spots. But, you know, really the number one pick, maybe the number two pick are going to be impactful. There's a consensus on number one. There's a kid from Oklahoma. Yeah. But
they're going to get a good player at four. They're going to get a good player at four.
Yeah. Yeah. You may not get the big man you want, but it raises the question, and we should talk about this, if not today, then another day. You have to honestly think about the possibility of trading that pick.
Mm.
I mean, what are the needs of the Toronto Raptors?
Why would you do that?
Well, because you need a big man.
Yeah.
If you resign Lowry.
I know we've got to go, but this becomes the key question: is where is this team in its development? And I'm much more of a, this is a long term, not a short term. And if you can get a good player at four, you take the player at four. You don't do what, I know the NBA is different than the other sports, but if you can get a quality player at four, you're not trading that.
Well, if you get we're going to get into the argument. That's not what I intended here. Why don't we do this? I'll shut up. Let's get some basketball guys on and debate this point, because we don't have a whole lot of time to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really intriguing based on where the Raptors are, the fact that they're going to have to make a decision on Lowry. One of the guys in this group is a guard who shoots like crazy, but they also need a big guy. So in the coming days, hopefully we'll address this situation in terms of,
I'll talk to the producer,
at least conversationally. That'll do it for us for today. We wish you a fine one, and see you tomorrow. Goodbye, everybody.